Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review bring you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the medical monopoly when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said, he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? What if a carpenter said that? He who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client. Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor of law at the Hastings Law School when he said, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, and do so without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed. And a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court." Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. That's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. And remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. That number again, 417-273-4967. Or if you're online, you can go to our website and just click on to the page on our archived programs. And you can download that free general law CD package right there in the privacy of your own home. And I don't even have to send the package to you in a plain brown envelope. The medical monopoly. The medical monopoly. Have you ever heard that term before? The medical monopoly. Well, medicine is a monopoly, and anybody that practices medicine without a license from that monopoly is charged with a crime and prosecuted and jailed. That's called practicing medicine without a license. Here in America, that happens quite often. In fact, not too many years ago, there were many, many chiropractors constantly being harassed and prosecuted for practicing medicine without a license. They're not anymore. They're a recognized association now. But there was a time that the American Medical Association used their monopoly powers, and in fact, they still do. I mean, it's a monopoly, and it is used day in and day out to prevent anybody else from interfering with their monopoly to make money in the medical or in the health care field. they're so powerful that they're in Washington right now trying to get a medical health care bill put through. They'll succeed. It's political. It's monopoly. And they'll get just about what they want. They and the pharmaceutical industry are manipulated by an even bigger, badder group of people, which we call the Pharmacy Trust, or the Rockefeller Trust. We'll talk a little more about those trusts as we progress along, but let's take a look at medicine for a moment. You know, the practice of medicine may not be the world's oldest profession, but it is often seen to be operating on much the same principles. Not only does the client wonder if he's getting what he's paying for, but in many instances, he's dismayed to find that he's actually gotten something that he had not bargained for. An examination of the record shows that the actual methods of medical practice have not changed that much through the thousands of years since it began. The recently discovered Ebers Papyrus shows that as early as 1600 BC, more than 900 prescriptions were available to the physician, including opium as a pain-killing drug. And as late as 1700, commonly used medications included cathartics such as senna, aloe, figs, and castor oil. Intestinal worms were treated by aspidium roots, that's the male fern, pomegranate bark, worm seed oil, and in the East, this was obtained from the flowers of santonin, and in the Western Hemisphere, it was pressed from the fruit of the leaves of chenopodium. Analgesics, or pain relievers, were alcohol, hyoscyamus, that is the leaves of hyoscyamus, the opium poppy. Hyoscyamus contains scopolamine, used to induce twilight sleep, at least it is today in modern medicine. And in the 16th century, Arabs used things like colchicum, a saffron derivative for rheumatic pains and gout. Cinchonka bark, the source of quinine, was used to treat malaria. Chulmugra oil was used for leprosy, and ipecac for amoebic dysentery. Burned sponge at one time was used as a treatment for goiter. Its content of iodine provided the cure. Burned sponge contains iodine. That's what we put in salt today to prevent goiter. Midwives used ergo to contract the uterus. Some 200 years ago, the era of modern medicine was ushered in by Sir Humphrey Davies when he discovered he was the discoverer of anesthetic properties of nitrous oxide, laughing gas. Michael Faraday discovered ether, and Wilhelm Sertner isolated morphine from opium. Until the late 19th century, doctors practiced as freelance agents, which meant that they assumed all the risks of their decisions, and they could sue or be sued by their patients. The poor rarely encountered a doctor, as medical ministrations were generally confined to the rich and powerful. Curing a monarch could bring great rewards, but failing to cure him could be a fatal mistake. Perhaps it was the awareness of the personal risks of this profession which gave rise to the plan for monopoly, to level out the risks and rewards among a chosen few. The attempts to build up this medical monopoly have now created a modern plague, and while the resolve to maintain this monopoly has cost the public dearly in money and suffering. Almost 500 years ago, one of the first attempts to set up this monopoly took place in England. It was called the Act of 1511. It was signed into law by King Henry VIII in England, and made it an offense to practice physic or surgery without the approval of a panel of experts. The act was formalized in 1518 with the founding of the Royal College of Physicians. In 1540, barbers and surgeons were granted similar powers when the king granted approval of their company. They immediately launched a campaign to eliminate the unauthorized practitioners who had served the poor. Apparently, there's nothing new under the sun, as much the same campaign has long been underway here in the United States. This harassment of doctors who served the poor caused such widespread suffering in England that Henry VIII was forced to enact the Quacks Charter in 1542. Now, this charter exempted the unauthorized practitioners and allowed them to continue their ministrations. No such charter has ever been granted here in the United States, where a quack is not only an unauthorized practitioner, that is, one who has not been approved by the American Medical Association or one of the government agencies under its control, but he is also subject to immediate arrest. Now, it's interesting that the chartering of quacks is not one of the features of English life which was passed on to its American colonies. In 1617, the Society of Apothecaries was formed in England. In 1832, the British Medical Association was chartered. This became the impetus for the forming of a similar association called the American Medical Association here in the United States. From its earliest inception, the American Medical Association has had one principal objective: attaining and defending a total monopoly of the practice of medicine in the United States. This they have succeeded at. From its outset, the AMA made allopathy the basis of its practice. Allopathy was a type of medicine whose practitioners had received training in a recognized academic school of medicine and who relied heavily on surgical procedures and the use of medications. The leaders of this brand of medicine had been trained in Germany. They were dedicated to the frequent use of bleeding and heavy doses of drugs. They were inimical to any form of medicine which had not proceeded from the academies or the academies, and which did not follow standardized or orthodox procedures. Allopathy set up an intense rivalry with the prevalent 19th school of medicine, the practice of homeopathy. Now, this school was the creation of a doctor named Christian Henneman, and it was based on his formula, similibus serenter, like cures like. Homeopathy is of even greater significance to our time today because it works through the immune system, using non-toxic doses of substances which are similar to those causing the illness. Even today, Queen Elizabeth is still treated by her personal homeopathic physician at Buckingham Palace. Yet, here in the United States, organized medicine continues its frantic drive to discredit and stamp out the practice of homeopathic medicine. Ironically, Dr. George H. Simmons, who dominated the American Medical Association from 1899 to 1924, building that organization into a national power, had for many years run advertisements in Lincoln, Nebraska, where he practiced, which proclaimed that he was a homeopathic physician. clinical trials have shown that homeopathy is as effective as certain widely prescribed arthritic drugs, and also having the overriding advantage that it produces no harmful side effects. However, the accomplishments of homeopathy have historically been given the silent treatment, at least by the medical establishment here in the United States. Or, if it's mentioned at all, they are greatly misinterpreted or distorted. A classic case of this technique occurred in England during the devastating outbreak of cholera in 1854. Records from that time period showed that during this epidemic, deaths at homeopathic hospitals were only 16.4%, as compared with a death rate of 50% at the orthodox medical hospitals. This record was deliberately suppressed by the Board of Health of the City of London. Now, during the 19th century, the practice of homeopathy spread rapidly throughout the United States and Europe. Dr. Henneman had written a textbook, Homeopathica Materia Medica, which enabled many practitioners to adopt his methods. In 1847, when the American Medical Association was founded here in the United States, homeopaths outnumbered allopaths, the AMA-type doctors that we know of today, by more than 2-1. Because of the individualistic nature of the homeopathic profession and the fact that they usually practiced alone, they were unprepared for the concerted onslaught of the allopaths. From its very beginning, the American Medical Association proved that it was merely a trade lobby which had been organized for the purpose of stifling competition and driving the homeopaths out of business. By the early 1900s, as the AMA began to achieve this goal, American medicine began to enter its dark age. Only now is it beginning to emerge from those decades of darkness as a new, holistic movement calls for treating the entire physical system instead of concentrating on one affected part. A very distinctive feature of the American Medical Association's Allopathic School of Medicine was its constant self-advertisement and promotion of a myth, the myth that its type of medicine was the only one which was effective. This pernicious development created a new monster, a mad doctor as a person of absolute infallibility, whose judgment must never be questioned, and most certainly, his mistakes must never be mentioned. As Ivan Illich has pointed out in his shocking book, Medical Nemesis, the expropriation of health, published in 1976, not only has the effectiveness of the allopathic school of medicine proved to be the stuff of mythology, but the doctors have now brought new plagues into being. Illnesses, which Illich defines as iatrogenic, causing a plague which he terms iatrogenesis. Illich claims that this plague is now sweeping this nation, and he defines iatrogenesis as an illness which is caused by a doctor's medical intervention. Illich goes on to define three commonly encountered types of iatrogenesis. There's clinical iatrogenesis, which is a doctor-made illness. There is social iatrogenesis, which is deliberately created by the machinations of the medical industrial complex. And then there is cultural iatrogenesis, which saps the people's will to survive. Of these three types of iatrogenesis, the third may be the most prevalent. Advertisements for various medications call it stress. The difficulty of surmounting the problems of everyday life, which are caused by the totalitarian government and the sinister figures behind it, who operate it for their own personal gain. Confronted with this monstrous presence, which intrudes into every aspect of an American citizen's daily life, many people have been overcome by a feeling of hopelessness and are persuaded that there's nothing that they can do. In fact, this monster is extremely vulnerable because it is so greatly overextended, and when attacked, can be seen to be a paper tiger. Despite the American Medical Association's frantic claims of improving medical care, records show that the state of American health is declining. During the 19th century, it had shown steady improvement, probably because of the ministrations of the homeopaths. A typical disease of the period was tuberculosis. In 1812, the death rate from tuberculosis in New York was 700 per 100,000. When Koch isolated the bacillus in 1882, the death rate for tuberculosis had already declined to 370 per 100,000. In 1910, when the first TB sanitarium was opened, this rate had further declined to 180 per 100,000. By 1950, this death rate had dropped to 50 per 100,000, and medical records proved that a 90% decline in child mortality from scarlet fever, diphtheria, whooping cough, and measles occurred before the introduction of antibiotics and immunizations, at least from the period that the records show from 1860 to 1896. This was also well before the Food and Drug Act was passed in 1905, which set up governmental control of interstate commerce and drugs. In 1900, there was only one doctor for every 750 Americans, and they had usually served a two-year apprenticeship, after which they could look forward to earning about the same salary as a good mechanic. In 1900, the AMA Journal, which was already under the editorship of Dr. George H. Simmons, sounded the call to arms, and the growth of the profession must be stemmed if individual members are to find the practice of medicine a lucrative profession. One would find difficulty in reading in the literature of any profession a more determined demand for monopoly. But how was this goal to be achieved? Well, the Merlin who was to wave his magic wand and to bring about this dramatic development in the medical profession turned out to be none other than the richest man in the world, the insatiable monopolist John D. Rockefeller. Rockefeller, fresh from his triumph of organizing his gigantic oil monopoly, a victory as well bloodied as any ancient Roman triumph, Rockefeller, the creature of the House of Rothschild and its Wall Street emissary Jacob Schiff, realized that a medical monopoly might bring him even greater profits than his oil trust. In 1892, John D. Rockefeller appointed Frederick T. Gates as his agent, conferring upon him the title of head of all his philanthropic endeavors. Well, as it turned out, each of Rockefeller's well-publicized philanthropies were specifically designed to increase not only his wealth and power, but also the wealth and power of the hidden figures whom he so ably represented. Frederick T. Gates, first president to Rockefeller, was a plan to dominate the entire medical education system in the United States. The initial step was taken by the organization of the Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research. So in 1907, the AMA requested the Carnegie Foundation to conduct a survey of all the medical schools of the nation. Now, even at this early date, the Rockefeller interests had already achieved substantial working control over the Carnegie Foundations, which has been maintained ever since. And it's well known in the foundation world that the Carnegie Foundations, and there are several of them, are merely feeble adjuncts of the Rockefeller Foundation. The Carnegie Foundation named one Abraham Flexner to head up its study of medical schools. Coincidentally, his brother Simon was the head of the Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research. The Flexner report was completed in 1910, after many months of travel and study, and it was heavily influenced by the German-trained allopathic representation in the American medical profession. And it was later revealed that the primary influence on Flexner had been his trip to Baltimore. He had been a graduate of Johns Hopkins University. This school had been established by Daniel Coit Gilman. Gilman had been one of the three original incorporators of the Russell Trust at Yale University, now known as the Brotherhood of Death. Its Yale headquarters had a letter in German authorizing Gilman to set up his branch of the Illuminati in the United States. Gilman incorporated the Peabody Fund and the John Slater Fund, which later became the Rockefeller Foundation. Gilman also became an original incorporator of Rockefeller's General Education Board, which was to take over the United States system of medical education, the Carnegie Foundation, and the Russell Sage Foundation. At Johns Hopkins University, Gilman also taught Richard Ely, who became the evil genius of Woodrow Wilson's education. Gilman's final achievement in the last year of his life was to advise Herbert Hoover on the advisability of setting up a think tank. Hoover later followed Gilman's plan in setting up the Hoover Institution after the First World War. Now, this institution furnished the movers and shapers of the Reagan Revolution in Washington. Not surprisingly, the American people found themselves saddled with even more debt and an even more oppressive federal bureaucracy, all the result of Daniel Coit Gilman's Illuminati prospectus. Flexner spent much of his time at Johns Hopkins University finalizing his report. The medical school, which had only been established in 1893, was considered to be very up-to-date. It was also the headquarters of the German Allopathic School of Medicine in the United States. Flexner, who was born in Louisville, Kentucky, had studied at the University of Berlin. The president of the Zionist Organization of America, Louis Brandes, also from Louisville, was an old friend of the Flexner family. After Woodrow Wilson appointed Brandes to the Supreme Court, Brandes appointed himself a delegate to Paris to attend the Versailles Peace Conference in 1918. His purpose was to advance the goals of the Zionist movement at this conference. Bernard Flexner, who was then an attorney in New York, was asked to accompany Brandes as the official legal counsel to the Zionist delegation in Paris. Bernard Flexner later became a founding member of the Council on Foreign Relations and a trustee of the Rockefeller Foundation with his brother Simon. Let me put a little mark here in the margin. With that much under our belt, and let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives. All of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Now, be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417, and the number is 273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, tonight's report, The Medical Monopoly, is taken from the book by Eustace Mullins, Murder by Injection: The Story of the Medical Conspiracy Against America. This is Chapter 1. If you'd like a copy of the book, Murder by Injection, The Story of the Medical Conspiracy Against America, written by Eustace Mullins, it's put out by the National Council for Medical Research, Post Office Box 1105, Staunton, Virginia, 24401. Again, that's the National Council for Medical Research, Post Office Box 1105, Staunton is spelled S-T-A-U-N-T-O-N, Virginia, and the zip code is 24401, Staunton, S-T-A-U-N-T-O-N. Mullins has written a number of books, such as The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, My Life in Christ, The Difficult Individual Ezra Pound, The World Order, A Writ for Martyrs, The Curse of Canaan, The Rape of Justice, The Great Betrayal, The General Welfare Clause of the Constitution, and this book, Murder by Injection. Last I heard, Eustace Mullins is still alive and kicking. Now, when I met him 20 years ago, he was already an old man. But then again, 20 years ago, I wasn't an old man, so anybody over the age of 50 to me was an old man, and he was over the age of 50. Now, I think he was 70 then, and if he's still around, you know, that guy's got to be 90 years old. He was a captivating fellow when I met him. I think he's just as captivating today as he was then, if he's still alive. Hard to beat the content of this book. Now, I gave you a report last week on this thing called vaccination. And much of the information that I gave you last week on vaccination came from this medical monopoly, this murder by injection, written by a number of other authors. I'm surprised at how many people quote Eustace Mullins or take passages and excerpts out of his books. I see them everywhere. I see little snips here and there. And I said, gee, where did I read that? Where did I hear that before? And I sat down. I hadn't read this book. He put it out in 1988, 9800. It's been over 20 years. And I read this over 20 years ago, and I've reported on it before. This isn't my first report here on the book called Murder by Injection, but the title of it is a little deceptive. It's a little deceptive. When I see the title Murder by Injection, I think to myself, oh, this is a book about vaccinations. And there's only one chapter in here on vaccination. Just one chapter. Let's see if I've got it here. It's chapter 4, Death and Vaccination. Actually, the book covers the medical monopoly, quacks on quackery, the profits of cancer, death and vaccination, the fluoridation conspiracy, weather AIDS, the action of fertilizers, contamination of the food supply, the drug trust, the Rockefeller Syndicate, and an addendum. It covers so much more than just vaccinations that it's a hallmark of an expose of the conspiracy of the Illuminati, and written from a different perspective. There are many books out there on the Illuminati. There's no two ways about that. In rating this book, I rate it about a 1 in 20. About a 1 in 20. Now, Mullins himself has written 10 books here. Let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Well, this would be the ninth one that I see written here, and I think he's written a lot more than that. But the moral to the story is, when I read a book, sometimes people ask me, how did you come up with this rating? And can you give me the books that you rate 1 in 100 or a 1 in 20? Solomon made an observation one time. He said that of the writing of books, there is no end. And he said that around 900 B.C., which is, pushing 3,000 years ago. So nearly 3,000 years ago, Solomon said, of the writing of books, there is no end. Hey, in those days, they wrote them by hand. Today, we got printing presses. I mean, we're printing books today like you can't believe. So when you pick up a book and you say, my God, I could read 100 books before I would come up with a book like this. I have never read anything like this. I can't say that in this case here, because I have read lots of books that deal with cancer, lots of books that deal with vaccination, lots of books on fluoridation and AIDS and the food supply and the Rockefellers and the drug trust and so on. So I'm not prepared to say that if you read this book, it's going to tell you something you've never heard before. I don't think so. But I think you're going to hear it in a way that you've never thought of before. So that's Eustace Mullins. And so I wished I had written the book. I wished I could take the credit. I wished I was as smart. But I'm not. So I'm just Joe Sixpack, the reporter, reporting to you on Murder by Injection. But I wanted to tell you that the subject matter of vaccination is actually not the subject matter of the book. It's only one chapter. The real subject matter of the book is the American Medical Association and medical quackery practiced by allopathic medicine. We are practicing medicine today much the same way that we practiced medicine 1600 BC. Not much has changed between what we're doing today and what we did, 3,600 years ago. 3,600 years of practicing medicine hasn't changed. We've changed a lot of names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, but by and large, it's about the same program. Now, Mullins goes on identifying a fellow by the name of Simon Flexner. Simon Flexner had been appointed the first director of the Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research at its organization in 1903. Abraham Flexner joined the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching in 1908, serving there until his retirement in 1928. He also served for years as a member of Rockefeller's General Education Board. He was awarded a Rhodes Memorial Lectureship at Oxford University. His definitive work was published in 1913, Prostitution in Europe. Abraham Flexner submitted a final report to Rockefeller, which apparently was satisfactory in every way. Its first point was an emphatic agreement with the AMA's lament that there were too many doctors. The Flexner solution was a simple one. It was to make medical education so elitist and so expensive and so long and drawn out that most students would be prohibited from even considering a medical career. And today, it takes 9 years. 9 years. 7 years in college and 2 years as an intern in order to get your medical license. It's an elitist program, and it's totally dominated and it's totally controlled. It's controlled by the American Medical Association, number one, and it's controlled by the government, number two. No doctor in this country has any freedom whatsoever to practice medicine. None. Let me give you an illustration. I had a guy here one time. I've forgotten his name. I might think of it here in a minute. And he was a cancer researcher. As I recall, he was out in California. And he wanted, he came up with a cure to cancer, and he wanted to promote that. He was a cancer researcher, and he wanted to use alternative methods outside the scope of the medical orthodoxy of the American Medical Association. Bruce Halsted. Bruce Halsted. Let me write that down. Dr. Bruce Halsted was his name. And Halsted called me, and he'd already been arrested and jailed, and he said, Gordon, I've heard a lot about you, and I need to hire you to help me defeat this medical monopoly. And I was saddened. I had to explain to this guy, and there was a lady at the National Institute of Health. Let's see if I can think of her name. She had called me and she said, well, could you help Dr. Halsted? Now, this National Institutes of Health, that's not a government institution, that's private. And it's made up of chiropractors and alternative healthcare practitioners. And I talked to the guy and I explained this to him. So let me explain it to you so that you'll understand how this thing works. The plan by the Rockefellers to take over the medical industry in America is genius, absolute genius. They have succeeded, past tense. I mean, it isn't something that's going to happen if you and I don't vote for the right guy in the next election. So it doesn't require that you vote for anybody. And it could be changed, but it would have to be changed by Congress. And these people own Congress. The American Medical Association, the Rockefeller and Carnegie Foundations, the think tank institutes like the Hoover Institute, the Council on Foreign Relations, Listen, the Bilderbergers and so on, these people own Congress. They own the White House. Now, the average Joe Sixpack American, he goes to the polls and he votes for the candidate, jackass or candidate Dumbo. But these candidates are selected by David Rockefeller. Selected by. Now, in my county, to give you an illustration, our county here, I think we have about 3,000 voters total. 2,600 of them are Republicans. And I think 288 are Democrats, or something like that. And in our county, we have a very active Masonic lodge here. There's several lodges, it isn't just one, but several Masonic lodges. Every political candidate in Ozark County is a Mason. Every public office holder is a Mason, without exception. And you have to have the blessing of the Masonic order in order to get the Republican nomination. Now, anybody can run as an independent, and anybody can run as a Democrat. But to get elected here, you have to have the endorsement of the Republicans, or you're not going to get... I mean, if you can't become the Republican nominee, and the only way you can become the nominee is to be a Mason, that's the end of the argument. All right, let's carry this up a little bit further. President Obama, if you want a judgeship in the United States, President Obama is going to appoint you to a judgeship. And the only way that you can be appointed to a judgeship is if you're already pre-approved. So you have to be approved by the Bilderbergers, the Council on Foreign Relations. You've got to be approved by David Rockefeller and the Hoover Institute. I don't think you necessarily have to have the approval of the Bank of International Settlements, which is the top tier think tank or the top tier control group, but you've got to be a member of the establishment in order to get in here. So now going back here to medicine, if you're a bright and intelligent, articulate young person, you can get a scholarship to go to medical school. But if in medical school you get crosswise with the medical establishment, you're not going anywhere. Period. You're out. Now, assuming that you can get your license to practice medicine, and many young people can do that, like Bruce Halstead. Now, if at any time in your career you come up with a cure to cancer, you're out of the medical association because they will not allow a cure to cancer in allopathic medicine. Absolutely won't allow it. Now, these are the very same people that organize places of cancer research, such as the Johns Hopkins Hospital, University Hospital, and the American Cancer Society. I mean, these are institutions that are set up by the Rockefeller Foundation. They're owned by and controlled by them. So what they do is they control the entire argument. They control cancer by controlling all of the players that play in the cancer game. They control all of the people who are the research scientists in cancer. So if a research scientist like Bruce Halstead finds a cure to cancer and says, here's what we got to do to cure cancer, they say, wait, this is a $500 billion a year industry. We don't want a cure now, Bruce. We don't want a cure. What we want is research. We want you to keep researching. We want you to research and research. And Halstead said, but I've found the answer. And wait. No. We cannot have the answer to cancer. So you go back to your test tubes, and you just keep working away. And you take your findings here on this cancer cure, and you burn those, and you look for another one. And you just keep collecting money. And Halstead was getting paid well. All of these research scientists, they get paid. There's no problem there. So all of the research that you people see, you run out here and you join up and you march on cancer and you run for cancer and you donate money to cancer. Well, you're honest and you're sincere and you mean well. And God love you, but you got your head up the wrong end of your anatomy here, not understanding the politics of cancer. It's like Bruce Halstead saying. So anyway, Halstead was prosecuted, he was convicted, he was jailed, he had his license taken away from him, and I was the guy I had to tell him. I said, now listen, you're a licensed medical professional. You have to play the game under the terms and conditions of your licensing, and if you don't, you're going to prison. And that's the way it is. That's what a license is all about. A license is permission to do something that's otherwise illegal, unlawful, a tort, or a trespass. And it's illegal or unlawful for you to introduce any kind of a cure or treatment for cancer that's not authorized. And the only way that can be authorized is through the American Medical Association, AMA. And they have a standard procedure. It's called cut, burn, and poison. That's it. You can use surgery. You can use radiation. You can use chemotherapy. God help you if you come in here with Essiac or Indian black salve or diet or anything like that. I mean, you're dead, dead on arrival. And that's what's being reported here in the book on murder by injection. And so I'm just hitting the tip of the iceberg here. I wished I could read you the whole book, but I can only read little sections and segments of the subject matter in here, which I'm going to cover several of these subjects as we progress along. Let's break them down. Now, the Flexner program set up requirements for 4 years of undergraduate college and then a further 4 years of medical school. His report also set up complex requirements for the medical schools. They must have expensive laboratories and other equipment. As the requirements of the Flexner report became effective, the number of medical schools was rapidly reduced. By the end of World War I, the number of medical schools had been reduced from 650 to 50. Get this, between 1913, when they started this program, and the end of World War I, 1918, 5 years. They reduced the number of medical schools from 650. Now, most of these medical schools, remember, were not allopathic medical schools. They were homeopathy medical schools. And so all they kept was the allopathic medical schools, made it so damn difficult and so hard to get in. And what was the reason for this? Cut down competition. Cut down on competition. Now, doctors are scarce and they're few and far between, and they get a lot of money to practice their ministrations and sprinkle holy water on you now. They get paid a lot of money. The number of annual graduates had been reduced from 7,500 to 2,500. The enactment of the Flexner restrictions virtually guaranteed that the medical monopoly in the United States would result in a small group of elitist students from well-to-do families, and that this small group would be subjected to intense controls. So any of you doctors out there, you know, that listen to this program, and you already know that's the way the game is played. So for your own benefit, as my old mentor, Ben Rice, told me. Ben Rice was a lawyer. And one day we were having lunch over at the Pizza Hut in Kuna, Idaho, and I said, Ben, if you had this to do over again, would you select law as your career? And he said, no, I wouldn't. And I said, why not? And he said, because it's a sleazy, dirty, dishonest business. That was Ben Rice, the lawyer, the Mormon lawyer. He said, it's a dirty, sleazy, dishonest business. But he said, I'm 55 years old, and it's the only thing I know. I have to practice law. It's the only thing I know. That's where you doctors are. You have to practice medicine. It's the only thing you know. I mean, you've already spent 10 years just going to school to get your ticket. Now you find out, like a master mason, that you're worshiping Satan the devil. The highest and brightest light in masonry at the 30th degree is when you have now been informed that the highest form of Satan worship is masonry. All right, welcome to the club, because this is where you're at. Now, Halstead woke up one day and said, "Oh my God, this is criminal." Yeah, that's right. The medical monopoly is criminal. The legal monopoly is criminal. But it violates the law of God. That's what the criminal portion of it is. It should shock and violate the ethics of the average Joe Sixpack, which when these people find this out, it is shocking. I've had many doctors tell me that they've absolutely been shocked by the criminal behavior of the American Medical Association. It is a criminal institution, just like the American Bar Association is a criminal institution. And the thing that legalizes it is the Congress and the state legislatures. It's never been legalized by the creator of the universe, God Almighty, you know, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He has consistently said for 3,600 years that these are criminal institutions and the people that participate in them are criminals. He's never varied in his assessment of medicine and law. He has condemned them both. Go to Luke chapter 11. There's a third profession in here called preachers, that is the clergy. He's never had a good word for a banker, a lawyer, or a preacher. So the Flexner Report cost the average American citizen, or what has it? Well, some recent statistics throw light on the situation. The New York Times reported that in 1985, the cost of health care per person in the United States is $1,800 a year. In England, it's $800 a year. In Japan, it's $600 a year. Yet both England and Japan rank higher on the scale of quality of medical care than does the United States. Compared to Japan, for instance, which has a higher living standard than the United States, but which furnished its citizens with quality medical care for $600 per year per person, comparative medical care in the United States can't be valued higher than $500 per year per person. That's $1,300 per person difference. It is the $300 billion per year looting of the American public by the medical monopoly in overcharges, criminal syndicalist activities, and the operations of the drug trust. That's what's going on here. A little later on, we'll take a look at this subject here called the drug trust. I mean, that's a story all of and by itself. But I wanted to introduce you here to the medical monopoly. Remember the book? It's called Murder by Injection. The Library of Congress catalog number is 88-060-694. Copyrighted 1988. You can't get this in any library in America. It has been banned from the libraries of America. You can't get it. In fact, you may be able to get this from Barnes & Noble, but I'm not sure that you can. But you can get it if you go to P.O. Box 1105, Staunton, S-T-A-U-N-T-O-N, Virginia, 24401. You'll be glad you did. It's one of those 1 in 20 reads. You'll read 20 books before you'll find one like Murder by Injection by Eustace Mullins. Hey, I'm out of time. Let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and or the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.